Cognitive Spark are bringing mixed reality in a really usable form to where the end user needs to have knowledge and information to enable the individuals to take advantage of advanced manufacturing technologies.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Robot Industry Podcast. It's my pleasure today to introduce you to Duncan McSporran. He's the COO of Cognitive Spark, a remote support company located in Fredericton, New Brunswick. Welcome to the podcast, Duncan.
Thanks very much, Jim. It's great to be here.
And Duncan, can you tell us, our audience, a little bit about yourself, and then we'll get you to talk a little bit about what's happening at Cognitive Spark?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the two co-founders of Cognitive Spark, and our main app market product is Remote Spark. I'm obviously by my accent, a born and bred New Brunswicker, but originally from the northwest of the UK, and moved to Canada as a on secondment to the Canadian Army. And after being here for a short period of time, I decided, and my family decided, that we really wanted to make New Brunswick our home, and then left the military. And I was very fortunate at that stage that it made a very good group of friends in the innovation sector, in particular in aerospace and defence, and met Ryan Groom, who's my business partner at Cognitive Spark. And at that point in time, he had been introduced to a piece of equipment called the Microsoft HoloLens. It's a hardware platform marketed by Microsoft. And we were talking about the possibilities for that. And this was prior to it being at market. It hadn't been commercially released at that stage. And we realized that there was going to be a massive potential for the way in which the concept of augmented or mixed reality would change the way in which people approach work in so many different ways. And we'll get to some of those, I'm sure, fairly soon. But what it really led us to do was to found the company, which we set up in 2016, and to look at really what the potential for this was in this great new era that we're moving into, which, you know, is epitomized by the expression, you know, of Industry 4.0 or the next technical revolution and lots of other expressions. But at the core of it, in so many different ways, is this concept of augmented or mixed reality. And really, that's what we do. And we create software solutions that really maximize the benefit of that for the customers and end users that we work with.
And let's talk about AR and VR right now, because it's a very exciting opportunity, especially, like you say, in advanced manufacturing. So where is the industry right now?
So it's at a significant crossroads, actually, Jim, and it's really timely that we're having this conversation right now, because what we're seeing is a really significant convergence. And I use those terms, you know, a lot when I'm talking about the space that we work in. And it's a convergence between the capabilities that we have at our disposal. The Microsoft HoloLens is one example of that. The enhanced and really sort of extended use of cloud computing, which is another aspect of advanced manufacturing. But importantly, an understanding on the part of the customer and the end user in the commercial context of what the power of augmented mixed reality is and what it can bring to their operations, whether those are in a fully commercial sense or whether they're in the public sector, where we have significant traction as well.
And why is this important? And I'm assuming 5G has something coming in around for you as well.
Yeah, 5G will play an important part. And again, it's really almost the way in which 5G is opening people's eyes to what the benefit of being able to access data is, and how we can utilize that data in a much more efficient way than we have previously done. The expression that we come across quite often is the term the final mile. And in advanced manufacturing and in the digital age, you know, as we transition into the Industry 4.0 era, that has generated massive amounts of data, which resides on servers or hard drives or thumb drives or, you know, on iPads and tablets. But it has been generated right from, in many cases, the start of development of systems. So when highly engineered systems are being designed, they're designed digitally. When the service options are being designed, they're being designed so that they can be delivered on a laptop or onto a mobile phone or something along those lines. But where we've got one of those really sort of significant inflections is where that data is either near real time, or it's being used in a way which allows a user to visualize something which is not possible on a phone or on a tablet. And they're able to see things as if they were looking at that object, as if it was just really a digital replica of that object. The expression that a lot of people, and in my opinion, it's overused, is they talk about digital twins. Actually, it's a digital replica. It's not a twin. So what they can do is they can look at a piece of equipment and they can have the information relevant to the equipment that they may be needing to maintain or service or repair or install or commission. And they're able to do that in a way which allows them to be guided in a number of ways. And really that's where it takes people to put the headset on and it takes people to see an augmented or a mixed reality environment for the first time. And as soon as they see it, they go, right, okay, this is completely different. This is not what I was expecting. And those expressions, you know, are very common. I've heard people reflecting on that today in the office. You know, I've just come off a call and somebody said, I really didn't expect it to be this impactful or to be this profound in the way that it's made me think about what we can do from an operational perspective in our business.
And it's kind of hard to do this over a podcast, right? Because it is such a visual medium. And I can imagine, first off, I wanted to ask you, your product is a software product, really, because it's coming through an interface that you don't create, whether it's a laptop or a HoloLens or some other kind of glasses. So how does the product work?
The way it works is really it creates an incredibly effective communications channel. And I use that expression when I'm talking about things because it's easy for people to understand it. It's, you know, communication, that's what we do. And in order to be able to do our jobs and to perform functions on work sites and in other areas, we have to be able to communicate effectively. And so what our software does is it allows communication to occur, but it allows it in a digital way and a visual way. And again, going back to those human concepts, the most effective way to communicate is actually visually. The largest part of our brain is actually about how we ingest visual information and how we make it contextually relevant to our decision-making process in the most simplistic way. And so what we do is we create that bridge from the data to the human with a visual link, and we create a visualized environment. Now, what we do is not virtual reality. So virtual reality is where you're occluded from the real world. We're in the real world, and I could be wearing the headset now and I could be in my work environment and I would just be like I was wearing a sort of bulky pair of safety glasses. But what I then can have is I can have that data, which I was referring to, communicated to me and overlaid into my work environment. And in a way that actually allows me to control what that environment looks like. So I'm the user, I've got the headset on, and I'm being supported by you. And you may be in London and I'm in Fredericton. And you can provide me with digital assets, or you can allow me to choose what those digital assets would be. But at the same time, I'm controlling that. So I'm creating, in essence, a workspace where I've got various tools that might be a PDF. Two-dimensional, but still very useful. It might be a static two-dimensional image of some description or a three-dimensional hologram, or it could be an animation of a hologram, and all of that supported with other aspects as well. And what we do is we enable that to occur incredibly efficiently. And the reason we're able to do that is because we've created every line of code in our software from the ground up ourselves. It's a completely Canadian capability. Every other product at market that has our capabilities uses gaming tools. So they use one of the visualization tools such as Unity or Unreal Engine. And what we realized very early on was that where those are incredibly powerful and they're great tools for visualization, they wouldn't necessarily meet the needs and requirements of industry, partly from a security perspective, because they're very significantly in terms of their size and where the inputs and development of those softwares come from. But also importantly from the concept of getting it to where the end user needs it, because you need bandwidth in order to be able to communicate. And if you're using one of those tools, then you need very significant bandwidths in order to be able to communicate effectively. Whereas we work down at about 256K. We've got users that have used us and tested us very effectively down to 128 kilobytes. But notwithstanding that, that's really what our software does, and it's really a visual communications platform. That's what mixed reality is, and that's where we use the expression. So I know that was a long winded answer to a really simple question, but it's like you said we're on an audio channel, and I can't show this to you and the listeners. What I really hope to do is to be able to do that sometime in person with you.
We'll put some of the links in the show notes too, so somebody who's listening can go back and listen to the podcast or look at the notes. And I'm glad that you mentioned about security, because you are in some very secure places, and security is so important to Industry 4.0 and to advanced manufacturing today. So I think that's a really good start, because you would not get that in the consumer devices.
No, and it's, you know, the... My background as former military, I just sort of had information security and personal security, and then subsequently IT security sort of drummed into me from a very early stage. And it always surprises me how late people seem to think about security when they're developing new software, and how they fail to understand it, how relevant it is to their users. And it doesn't matter whether it's an industrial user trying to protect their intellectual property, or it's a federal user trying to protect national systems to protect them, to make sure that they're not subject to malicious attack. A lot of people just sort of tend to wrap security around after they've done everything else. And really, a fundamental aspect of what we did, and it's led us to some really great technical innovation in a number of ways, not just on the security side, is that we made sure that really what we set ourselves up as was a cybersecurity company to build mixed reality solutions. And a lot of that came from not only, you know, the end use cases that we identified at a very early stage as we were looking at what's the impact going to be, but also from Ryan Green, my business partner. He had previously had been set up a cybersecurity company, which was Microsoft's first gold partner for cybersecurity in Canada. And so his background in cybersecurity really sort of added a lot to our discussion at that stage about, you know, what we should do. We had to make some difficult choices. We designing something from the ground up, where you take every line of code and you form it into something rather than taking readily available off the shelf solutions is a challenge. And it's been something that we've done with our eyes wide open, but it's led to some really great capabilities for our customers. But also, it's meant that we've been able to address some of the other issues as well, which confront anybody who's trying to adopt this type of technology into the workplace, again, whether that's industrial or in the government sector and public sector.
So that's a good segue into my next question about what industries are in your bullseye. And of course, I'm very interested in all this machine building and robotics and custom machines, but you are in all kinds of industries. And what's in your bullseye?
I have a very big bullseye. And it's on the forehead of anybody that wants to talk about, you know, how this can really empower their workers and their team. And I know that sounds like I'm dodging the bullet. I'll come back to some of those industries in a moment. But the reality for me is that we identified personas that who's going to use this. And for me, it was really inspired by, again, my military service, of the people that used to maintain and fix all the kit that I used to break. And, you know, as an infantry officer, I broke an awful lot of kit. But I can remember, you know, one instance where when we were just about to launch some offensive operations. You know, this is, you know, in a real context where people's lives were very much on the line. And literally 2 days before we were due to start, a whole bunch of new equipment just turned up outside the back of my vehicle and was for the whole of my combat team. And my fitters and my mechanics just looked at it and went, well, what are we supposed to do with this? And what was even worse was the fact that obviously British Army, yeah, I speak French and so on, but the instructions were all in French. So my electrical mechanical engineers, my fitters, who were all from places like Birmingham and Manchester and London and everything, who could maybe say bonjour and that would be about it in French, were confronted with these large paper manuals on how to integrate this new equipment into our existing systems. And that person, that individual was really has been the persona that I've had in my mind, and that's been my bullseye. It's that individual who's on the scene in any kind of situation, is trying to do their work as effectively as they can for their team, whether it's a company, whether it's a federal department, or whether it's an army unit. They're all trying to do their very best. And how do we get the best support that we can to those individuals in order to enable them to do that work and to do it effectively? But importantly, from a human perspective as well, to that decision action cycle that they're going through, to give them the confidence that they're doing the right thing. And that's a really important aspect of, you know, I think what marks us out, we're not just a software company, we're really a human factors company, and in helping, you know, individuals to do that. And we get a lot of feedback from various customers, and again, the end users, the people using the systems, about that. I'll just give you a really good example. We work in the electrical power generation and transmission sectors. We've got systems deployed in nuclear power stations. One of our customers 2 years ago in the electrical power industry, they did a small scale trial. That was a part of our acceptance for them. And one of the things they did was say, right, okay, what we're going to do is you're going to ship one of the headsets with your software on it to a technician who's never used it before. And we're going to prepare some tools for them to use, so 3D repair by replacement animations, so holographic animations to show the individual about doing a task that they may have done previously, but they're not necessarily very familiar with. They're trained to do it, but not necessarily familiar with it. And what we want to do is just assess how quickly and easily that occurs. So the FedEx, UPS box, whatever it was, arrived for the technician. He was on site, ready to do the task. And 45 minutes later, he was using our software on a Microsoft HoloLens 2 to do that task.
Wow.
A task that he previously would have actually just gone, I can't do this. I don't know what it is. I've got to wait for an expert to arrive. And so somebody else would have been dispatched to the site with the delay and the additional costs, and so on. That's what would have happened in the electrical sector. In a lot of other sectors, what would happen is one of two things. You'd either stop and wait for the expert to arrive to give you the assistance that you need, or alternatively, you plow on. The individual plows on and does potentially gets it right, but also potentially it incurs massive amounts of re-engineering costs or further delays because they guess and they invariably get it wrong. It's human nature. Again, people want to do stuff and they want to get on and play their part in the team, and that's it. So again, you've asked me a question which allows me to talk a lot about something I'm really passionate about. The bullseye is on the end user. The bullseye is on that guy or that girl who's picking up a wrench to do a task that they're not necessarily familiar with or that they need assistance with. And that can be me helping them, you know, by guiding them through, by just sort of saying, yeah, go around the back, see that red switch, flick it to the right, push the green button 3 times, flick the switch back, and it'll restart. I know that's not the way that you think it'll work, but believe me, that's the way I've done it for the last 30 years, and it really does work. I can give you that experiential knowledge direct to you because I'm there, but also what I can do is I can drop into your field of view that communications that I've discussed already, that visualization of how to do things and what you might need to do. And then when you take that beyond that into, you know, how we connect into enterprise resource planning tools and so on, then you can see there's almost a use for this in almost every single industry. And every single time, what it's doing is it's enabling that person to do their job and play that part in the team more effectively. So whether it's nuclear, it's defense, it's automotive, it's power generation, you know, it's got a real the technology, not just our software, but the technology has a real power to amplify the abilities of those workers who are on scene trying to do the right thing.
I heard that one of your systems is being used by a very northern Canadian city. And I'm not sure if that was a press release or if it was at a trade show that I saw Cognitive Spark at. Yep. Maybe it's a mine.
It's actually in Resolute. So the most northerly township in civilian township in Canada. There's a couple of military bases further north than that, but that's the most one. And it's been used by the public sector. So that's the National Natural Resources Canada, NR Canada, are using that to support the local community and the work that they do up there. Yeah, it's a pretty challenging geographic environment to work in, and they were using that. They'd certainly been using it in January. We know that for sure. But the initial trials, which we did with them to prove that it would work, so that was guys on the ground in Resolute with a backhaul all the way to Ottawa. So they were being supported by experts in Ottawa. And again, some of the things that we can easily sort of talk about is the reduction. It needed one person to go to Resolute. It didn't need anybody else to go up to work on the issues that they were working on. And that in itself is great, because we're helping to those organisations to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by not having to fly as many people to different places as they need. One of the organisations we work with, one of the commercial companies we work with, has reported 60% of the reduction in their requirement to travel to site, and another one has reported it as high as 75%. So again, it's some of those other unexpected impacts that we didn't really think about when we set the company up and were developing this software. We now really see that benefit as we move forwards. And again, with the northern communities, you can imagine how this can empower those communities, because they can be supported much more readily than they are now.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like a real game changer for anybody who's in very far away places, but also people don't have to travel across the world to all these even big places to maintain and fix and troubleshoot machinery. How do you sell your product, Duncan? Do you sell it through integrators or direct?
I do it both ways. So we work with some really great partners, Microsoft being one of them, and a number of others that will be well known in the tech environment here in Canada and in a wider sense, Ingram and Insight and various other ones in our other territories, Europe and UK. We work with a team called MPH. And so on. But also what we do is work directly, especially with some of the larger companies who acknowledge the fact that, one, they don't have the expertise in mixed or augmented reality and identify with the recognition that Microsoft give to us as leaders in our field. So they'll just come to us straight up and say, can we do this? And we want to really sort of explore, one, what this will do for us, but also how can we integrate this into our existing infrastructure.
And are you venturing into the healthcare industry? It seems to me like such a really good fit.
Yes. Yeah, in the UK, actually. Ironically, we won a competitive tender with the UK National Health Service as part of their COVID coping mechanisms. We've got lots of other people here in Canada that have sort of said, we think this would work, but just don't seem to. There's a sort of risk aversion in certain parts of Canada would be the right thing to say. I think just not prepared to sort of take that step forwards and really utilize this. But lots of applications. And funnily enough, they're one of the first, one of our biggest customers is the Royal Canadian Navy. And one of their first use cases was for medical support to the Arctic offshore patrol ships, which won't have doctors on them as a normal member of the crew. So they have a military corpsman or paramedic trained individual. So, it just kind of makes sense to be able to support that individual with a rear link to surgeons. So if they find, if they have an incident or they're assisting, local community as they will be doing when they deploy on cruises into the far north, that then that individual can get that support that they need when they're faced by something which would otherwise be beyond their knowledge and experience. And strangely enough, that's that we were invited. It was killed by COVID, unfortunately, but we were invited by the US Navy to go on a cruise with the USS Mercy, which is one of their two dedicated hospital ships, to provide that in-depth support. And in that case, what it would be for medical triage, so the surgeons could provide to the corpsman, the US Navy corpsman on the shore. They could sort of say, right, okay, this is how we want people to be loaded up onto the helicopters to be brought back onto the Mersey. So, yeah, medical again, the number of applications there are significant. You know, whether it's setting up equipment in a blood donor centre, that's one of the discussions that we had that got to the point where we were nearly commissioned to do that, but then there was a change in leadership and ended up. But you know, from making sure that people who are setting up pieces of equipment are doing it right, or they just need that sort of reassurance from somebody that they've done something right, or that they need to repair a piece of equipment that they would otherwise wouldn't be familiar with. There's a lot of cases there. But like I said, we're already in the UK with the UK National Health Service, and we're having lots of discussions with lots of other teams here in Canada as well. And hopefully, you know, as the like I said earlier on in the discussion, we're at a real crossroads, and as people sort of understand that we're at that crossroads and that this technology is real, it's deployable now, it's already operational, then they can take advantage of it to enhance the healthcare, you know, that we can give, whether that's making sure the equipment's available or whether it's actually people being provided with guidance on treating individuals in ways that they otherwise wouldn't be able to do.
I was going to ask a question, Duncan, about return on investment, but it just seems like it's such a no-brainer when somebody is able to fix a machine and not send a team halfway across the world to fix something. But I imagine you have this conversation with some of your clients.
We do, and some for some people, it's really evident. We work on one of the largest privately owned shipping lines in the US. They didn't need to be convinced that there's going to be a return on investment. You know, they operate, you know, a large fleet of tankers and intercoastal barges and various other craft, and they already knew when they came to us. They said, "We know we're going to get a really great return on investment, and also what we'll be able to do is enhance safety within our fleet, and also what we'll be able to do is enhance knowledge transfer from our aging and retiring people that have been working with us, you know, for their entire careers. Well, we're losing that knowledge base that's walking out the door with them, and we can do different things to accommodate that by use of your type of technology." And you know, we sat down with them and mapped something out, and we're going through that process now, and we're in the sort of medium scale trial where I think we're on 10 of their ships now, but the actual plan is for it to be on every single one of their ships and in every one of the facilities that they own and in every one of the facilities that they manage on behalf of, you know, various agencies in the US. So there's lots there in terms of the way in which this can be sort of really addressed. And it literally, all we do is we try and get the headset on people's with our software on people's heads as quickly as we can, because as soon as we do, people go, "You could use it for that. You could use this for that. How? Why aren't we using this now?" And the return on investment piece just comes straight back to the fore. We have one. We've got an industrial partner in power generation, and they talked with us for a long time, but hadn't done the infrastructure work. So all of a sudden, they had a crisis. One of their power generation facilities was offline, and they then got back in touch with us and said, "Oh, you know that quote you gave us, is that still valid?" So we said, "Yep, certainly." So we had headsets with them with the software, you know, very, very rapidly after they'd spoken to us on a Sunday afternoon. They spent 10 days then going through the process of getting our systems onto their infrastructure. It's a work that really could have been done prior. After that, so 11 days after they got the systems and they got the systems fired up, they were able to solve the problem, which meant that that power station wasn't generating a watt of power. And they did that 14 days ahead of schedule. So you imagine a large multi-megawatt power station, which is sat idle, doing nothing. And the return on investment of 14 days regained in terms of productivity for that facility. And that customer estimated that the value for that was $23 million of savings. So the return on investment, that is, we're not going to get those every day. We're probably not going to get those every year. But the reality is that just by stepping forwards even in a sort of slightly more progressive way and starting to work out what processes can I use this for, or what do I need to do in order to be able to use this type of technology on our infrastructure. If you do that, if companies and organisations do that in advance, then they put themselves in a very good position to be able to use the the technology when it needs to be used. And we've got other customers that say, and one here in the Maritimes, that, you know, they estimate that every time they use our system, and they're kind of a break glass in type in case of emergency, which they do very frequently. But every time they use it, they're saving over $7,000 every time they use the system. Yes, people might be afraid of technology, they might be afraid of what's coming, but it is here, and it's here now. It's operational, it's deployed, and it's deployed with their competitors. Their competitors are using it to gain an advantage, because, again, in a lot of the industrial cases where it's a small or medium-sized company that's using our capability, they're using it in order to enhance the service or that they provide to their customers. And so if they're able to, increase the availability of equipment or reduce the outage time of critical infrastructure, then that reflects really well on them and reflects well on their team. And again, it comes back to that human, fixing something using augmented or mixed reality and going, wow, got that done. And I know I've done it faster than I would ever have been able to do it without the system. And everybody sort of, gets a little bit of a buzz out of that. And everybody's sense of purpose improves. And, everybody's learning experience improves because they're doing things that they've not necessarily done before. And it all helps to build into it's not just about the technology. It's about how the teams use the technology and how they get a lot of self-satisfaction out of that, but also how you reduce top line and bottom line costs for the operators and also the customers.
I see so many maintenance people that are just gurus that could extend their working life or could work from home because of this technology. So I think it goes to your earlier point about keeping all this tribal knowledge that we have and still being able to use it. So I think it's very, very exciting. What's the future of the industry for you? I mean, I just feel like you're getting started, but what do you see in the next few years as being impactful beyond 5G?
5G will play a part in it. I think in Canada as well, the other one that I'd mention is the availability of broadband low Earth orbit satellites, because that really has that impact in our rural community where 5G will never be commercially viable. In real terms, that type of connectivity allows much more widespread use of not just augmented or mixed reality, but so many other digital technologies as well. So, whether it's 5G or it's the LEO satellites or anything along those lines, connectivity into those communities, so that this type of technology can just become as mainstream as a mobile phone. So that's really key. Interesting enough, one of the other aspects that I think is ahead of us is a philosophical debate about the metaverse. Now, you'll notice I haven't mentioned the metaverse at all whilst we've been talking, because I think it's such an overused term, and nobody really understands what it means. And I think really for us that this step forwards now is as we move from augmented and mixed reality to spatial computing. And we can define spatial computing really well. It's how you relate digital assets to the world around you and how you're able to do that in a way which the brain can assimilate really readily. That aspect, I think, really is going to be key, I think, over the next 12 months to 2 years is defining things, defining the industry and the sector away from the very nebulous expression of the metaverse, which will apply in the consumer world without doubt, and will be maybe an overarching system. But actually, from a perspective that we're discussing here, which is advanced manufacturing and robotics and augmented reality and so on, it's how we define spatial computing and what it's going to mean. And in real terms, the technology that we need in order to make spatial computing every day is what we're developing. And just right next door with our development team, that's really where we're getting massive amounts of excitement. It's not just about how we connect to the worker to support the worker with information that we're pushing to them or that they're picking. It's how that worker is moving into a workspace and the digital information that they need in order to perform their task is being pre-populated into that space. And that's where the concept of spatial computing will become really, really, really powerful. You're going in there, and if you're the electrician who's on task, not the plumber, but if you're the electrician who's on task, your work list is there and the tools that you need in order to do the maintenance of the electrical systems that you're qualified to maintain is there for you, because the system knows that you're a level two electrician. It's not going to give you the work that a senior electrician would get. It's giving you that, and likewise, it's not going to give you the information for the plumbing systems or the HVAC systems or something along those lines. So what you end up with is simply much more efficient workflows for the individual, again, to just get on with what they need to do and what they're trained and skilled to do. When you sort of look at that as the core of a spatial computing capability, and then you sort of unthread that and you look at all the aspects of that, then it's going to be really transformational. And again, that's maybe an overused term, but it is going to be transformational in terms of how we train people, how we get the knowledge to the point of need, and importantly, how we much more efficient about the way that we maintain and operate systems. And again, I go back to the green aspects of ESG, of the environmental sustainability piece. We're going to be able to reduce the amount of time that people need to spend traveling to do on-site maintenance in a much more dynamic way. But we're also going to be able to maximize the benefit of that tribal knowledge that you mentioned, because as I get to 65, I don't really want to stop working completely, but I'd be happy to maybe do 10 hours a week where I've got my laptop and I'm available for calls to support Jim or Sarah, who've only just started doing what I've just been doing for the last 35 years. We'll get so much more cross-generational communication. My mum is still very, very active at 95 years old, and she's back in the UK. And I remember when the first time I put the whole lens on her head, and she just said, "So what do I need to do?" And I just said, "All you need to do is just push your finger and push the little icon as if it's a button." And 15 minutes later, she was just in a completely different environment, working on things, doing things that she'd never thought she would be able to do at 95. Well, the simplicity of augmented mixed reality, when it's kept simple, can really enable that. Like I said, that cross generational piece as well. I could go on for hours talking about where we're going to go from a business perspective and from an industrial perspective. We're just going to be really enabling our teams to work much more efficiently and keep systems going. We've got a really great story, actually, from one of our local companies. And for listeners here in Eastern Canada particularly, you might know the company called Ganong. They're a chocolate and candy manufacturer. They actually have always been innovators. They were the company to have made the first chocolate candy bar with a filling in it, and they still make that today. As you'd expect a company like that to do, they buy state-of-the-art equipment for their production lines. And recently they had a system installed that was made in Australia. As you'd imagine, with COVID, no engineers could get to site. The system arrived and it was installed according to the instructions. And they had the old sort of holding the phone up saying, "We're doing this right," kind of thing. But they couldn't actually get the line that they'd bought to operate at the efficiency that they wanted it to do. So they brought us in. They have our systems now operating in their production lines. But what happened was one of the production engineers at Ganong was walking along the line, and the engineers in Australia were looking. They were on their expert end of the call, looking at things and sort of saying comments. And one of the engineers in Australia just sort of said, "Stop, look up." And the production engineer looked up, and there was a ticking noise coming from a piece of equipment above her head, which was part of the production line. He said, "That's the problem." They were able to do that in, I can't remember how long it was, but in real terms, those two engineers in Australia didn't fly from Australia to St. Stephen in New Brunswick. And it's just another really good example of, somebody would have to pay for that. But also there's all those extra pieces of equipment. But now there's a confidence between the two organizations that they can support each other, and also that they can communicate effectively using the system. And again, whether that's use of digital assets, which the original equipment manufacturer can push down that pipe to Ganong in St. Stephen, or whether it's in terms of that first person over the shoulder support, which was so effective in that case. And literally the system, once that had been identified, the system the next day was running at 100% capacity. for the first time.
Duncan, this has been fascinating. Thank you for coming on the podcast. How do people get in touch with you if you there want to hear more or they want to do a demo or something?
I'm sure there'll be some links and so on in the podcast. I'm Duncan at cognitivespark.com. It's spelled K-O-G-N-I-T-I-V, Spark, and so on. But you can find me very easily on LinkedIn. There are not that many McSporrans in the world, and there are even fewer Duncan McSporrans. So please look me up on LinkedIn, and I'm normally able to respond on there, and then I'll just connect with people through whatever means they want to, phone call, email, whatever.
Thank you, Duncan. Our sponsor for this episode is Earhart Automation Systems. Earhart builds and commissions turnkey solutions for their worldwide clients. With over 80 years of precision manufacturing, they understand the complex world of robotics, automated manufacturing, and project management, delivering world-class custom automation on time and on budget. Contact one of their sales engineers to see what Earhart can do for you. And Earhart is spelled E-H-R-H-A-R-D-T. And I'd like to thank and acknowledge our partner, A3, the Association for Advancing Automation. They are the leading trade association in the world for robotics, vision and imaging, motion control and motors, and the artificial intelligence technologies. Visit automate.org to learn more. And I'd like to thank our partner, Painted Robot. Painted Robot builds and integrates digital solutions. They're a web development firm that offers SEO and digital social marketing and can set up and connect CRM and other ERP tools to unify marketing, sales, and operations. And you can find them at paintedrobot.com. And if you'd like to get in touch with us at the Robot Industry Podcast, you can find me, Jim Beretta, on LinkedIn. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Be safe out there. Today's podcast was produced by Customer Attraction Industrial Marketing, and I'd like to thank my nephew, Chris Gray, for the music, my partner, Janet, A3, Painted Robot, and our sponsor, Earhart Automation Systems.